This is the Sports Illustrated Boxing Podcast.
It's boxing.
A look inside boxing with Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix. Interviews, analysis, and everything going on in boxing. And now a man who I wish was called the Boston Bleeder.
All doctors to the ER.
It's sort of like getting punched in the face.
Chris Mannix.
Hi. Welcome back to another episode of the Sports Illustrated Boxing Podcast. Glad you could join me this week. Another busy week in boxing with some of the fights we've had and certainly some drama still out there as we record this podcast. Gennady Golovkin still has not made a decision on where he is going to go for his next fight or fights. We've got some great ratings over at Fox, DAZN doing some things, and of course the Kovalev-Alvarez rematch is coming up on ESPN Plus this week. And to talk about that and much more, I'm pleased to bring in Evan Rutkowski, who does a great job with his podcast, the Fisticionados podcast, which is on the Leave It in the Ring radio network. It takes a deep dive into the business of boxing a couple times a month. Evan also, of course, worked over at HBO for about 7 years, and I'm glad he could come and join me in studio. Evan, thanks for coming in, man.
Thank you for having me. I'm a big fan of your show, so it's nice to be on.
So is it a couple times a month? I wasn't sure. How often does the podcast come out?
I try to do it every other week. So usually okay. I'm going to record. The ratings play a big part in it. So I'm going to wait till I get real ratings like on Tuesday, and I'll try to record Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday night, like in that range, and get it out before the weekend.
It's an interesting podcast. That's how I first got wind of you and what you were doing. And I mean, how did you decide to get into this kind of media gig? You were with HBO for a while, and then
with HBO. My wife and I kind of made a life decision to move. We were living in New York, and I was working for HBO. And I love combat sports in general, love the sport of boxing. Made a life decision to move back to Los Angeles. We actually met in Los Angeles. So when that happened, I knew I was not going to be working in the sport of boxing anymore. And I, you know, took a new job at a startup company and just wanted to stay involved in the sport and just thought there might be an audience for something like this. Like, this was stuff that we at HBO talked about regularly, and I found it really interesting, and I had no idea if there would be an audience or not, but apparently there is, and I have a lot of fun doing it.
Yeah. I mean, as someone that works in the NBA and in boxing, the two most gossipy sports out there, where transactions or non-transactions generate the most amount of interest. People can't stop in basketball, and they can't stop talking about Anthony Davis and where he's going to go. And boxing, it's Golovkin, it's Canelo, it's will this fight get made? Can these promoters get along? The gossip of boxing, man, it's big.
It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. Even with the NBA stuff, I actually find myself, I read more about the NBA gossip than I actually watch the NBA games.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a 12-month-a-year sport because of that. And boxing, on a lesser degree, to a lesser degree, is the same way. But I'm glad you're in because you're very much plugged into the business of boxing and ratings and everything and sort of making sense of all this. So I want to dive into it with what we saw this past weekend. Last weekend, the Fox broadcast, headlined by Keith Thurman and Josita Lopez, they drew an average audience of 2.5 million viewers. It peaked at around 2.8 million viewers. That number topped the pretty solid number Fox did in its debut on December 22nd, which averaged close to 2 million viewers. And the FS1 show that we saw a couple weeks back, Caleb Plant, he wins a piece of the super middleweight title. That fight averaged around 760,000 viewers, peaking at close to 1 million, which is a great number, I think, for FS1. So talk to me, Evan, about the Fox debut, the first three or four fights that they've had, three really, on their platforms. What have you made of what the audiences have been and what it means for the future of boxing on Fox?
Well, to echo your sentiment, I actually think the most impressive number out of all this is the FS1 number. I think that's a really sustainable, that's close, if not all, you know, if not better than a lot of what they were doing with the UFC. And you got to remember, there when you look at ratings, a lot of it, especially when you look at the networks, you have to compare not just, you can't just live in this myopic boxing world. Like, yes, it's great to have more people watching boxing, especially on Fox, but like if you look at the average number of people who are watching FS1 most of the time, it's a tiny number. And then when you do a great number like that, that really means you've drawn active people to come to FS1 and watch boxing. That's really impressive. The, you know, the stuff on Fox, the first one I wasn't too impressed with, you know, if you look at what was happening on the other networks, it finished second in the ratings from 8 to 10 p.m., and actually all the other networks were showing reruns, and I think like a Dateline rerun on NBC still beat it. Mm-hmm. Now, it did end up peaking a little bit higher later, and I think it's an okay start to it, but if you're showing live sports, you should be beating reruns. Now, the Thurman fight, that there's some real hope there. I mean, that's a good number. The NBA kind of blew it out of the water. The NBA was on ABC, but it beat the NHL All-Star Game, which I think is really significant. And, you know, what CBS was doing, CBS sort of, in terms of the ratings that really matter, 18 to 49, they didn't have a great number, but they actually did a lot more total viewers. I think they did some kind of 48-hour show or something like that. It did like 4.8 million people, but it's almost all people over 50 watching it, which isn't what advertisers care about as much. But
what?
Go ahead.
I just want to jump in with these numbers and how they kind of played out. How much credit do you give the promotion during these football broadcasts? Because I remember, and I forget what the game was, but the Caleb Plant fight versus Ustagagi. Well, I'm going to say his name wrong again. that fight got massive promotion on the Fox football broadcast on Sunday, and that Fox window is huge. Like that's their highest rated show by far, right? I mean, that's a big broadcast for them. How much credit do you give? Maybe credit's the wrong word, but how much of an effect do you think that had on the numbers for the FS1 show?
A huge effect. I mean, those NFL playoff games are some of the most watched television shows of the year. Like, that's just, they're going to end up in the top 20, you know, maybe even the top 10 of most watched TV shows of the year, those playoff games. So it's a huge amount of credit to it. And I think you can look at it two ways. Like, there's the people who want to say, oh, well, you gave it such a platform and it still only did, you know, that number where it peaked almost at a million. You know, I disagree with that take. I think you're starting a whole new brand on you know, I know they did have some shows on FS1, but this is sort of the first high-level PBC boxing we've seen on FS1. And it's just really impressive on your first show to do that kind of number, even with that much promotion. But yes, that is the kind of promotion that really matters a lot. Credit Fox and the PBC for making that work out. I mean, I think it also affected the Thurman fight, too. I mean, you saw a lot of that, not quite as much on the FS1. And some of that is just there's not many other sports happening on Fox right now, so that's a little bit of luck. So they're promoting that a lot. But I saw a lot of it, too. I watched those football games, and they were everywhere. You couldn't miss them.
Yeah, for people that say you only did a million viewers, you still have to change the channel. Like, it wasn't
exactly
like it came on right after Fox. You had to go find FS1 to go see that fight. So I thought that was a great number and a great cross promotion. The other interesting thing to me, and I wonder what this means for the future, is that these weren't great fights. I mean, the Plant fight was good. Maybe you thought coming into a Caleb Plant had a chance, but the opening main event where Charlo got a tougher fight than we thought maybe from Korobov, but we all thought going in Charlo was a big favorite. Thurman, you couldn't go anywhere without rating this as a shake off the rust fight for Keith Thurman. That still did a good number. What does that mean to you about these ratings?
Well, hopefully it means that if casual fans come in, they're seeing decent fights. I mean, the Thurman fight, I would say that wasn't close, but it was at least good television. Mm-hmm. So that's the positive part of that. When the PBC announced its fights, I mean, they will have to address this down the line. Not every fight where there's a huge favorite is going to work out to be good television. You know, they will need to produce some of these fights that are either closer and sort of show casual fans that this can be exciting with, you know, maybe you don't know who's going to win. Because we all kind of knew Keith Thurman was going to win that fight going in. Mm-hmm.
Does that, do you think that motivates, my fear with a good number is that maybe it makes an Al Haymon or whoever's is making these matches, some of the promoters involved, maybe it makes them less likely to want to put a top-tier fight together because they could say, well, if we're doing 2.5 million peak at 2.8 with a mismatch, maybe we want to keep preserving these big fights down the road for pay-per-view. I guess to boil it down, my fear would be that we only get the top-tier fights on pay-per-view and Fox gets relegated mismatches and warm-up fights.
I think that's my fear too. I mean, that's you. If you look at the strategy that Fox seems to be employing, you know, and I've made this reference before, like maybe this is what HBO used to have as like Boxing After Dark, and then there's Showtime sort of with the PBC World Championship Boxing, and then they do all these pay-per-views. And if I guess the good news is on a number like this, if you keep making good television, people will still watch. But if a couple more mismatches, I just don't think that'll be the case. But, you know, the flip side of it is, what is a victory for Fox? Because, you know, when you look at the ratings in totality, they still need to make enough money to sell ads, you know, properly. And there's this, the way you have to think about it for networks is sort of a concept like, you know, sort of a wins above replacement concept. Like, Fox can just go back to sticking in Cops or reruns of Cops, and it'll still do a great number. Like, it's because it's big Fox. So if it gets...
I love Cops.
Great no, job. Exactly. I mean, it does a great number. So if they get to the point, and you saw it on December 22nd, where all the other networks are putting on reruns, there's nothing cheaper than to put on a rerun. So if that gets you close to what you're getting here with boxing, like, that's not a good sign.
When you looked, I mean, when you're watching these broadcasts, do you look at the ads or the type of ads that are going on these shows?
Most of the time, yes. So sometimes I have a 2-year-old, and a lot of times I don't start them right on time, so I zip through them, especially if there's like 3 fights in a weekend. But if it's something I'm going to talk about on my podcast, I pay really close attention to it.
So what have you noticed on these ads? Any of these 3 fights?
Well, it's big. So you do see ads for big brands. You certainly see it on ESPN. You definitely see it on Fox. On Fox, there's still a lot of stuff that's PBC promotion type material,
yeah.
Which is not an encouraging sign. But the demos of people who watch boxing in this day and age are much more in line with what advertisers want. And that's an encouraging sign. And I think you've seen that happen, certainly on ESPN. I think on the big Fox fights, you've seen that pretty good stuff from that too so far.
Yeah, I was remember the only time I looked for the ads was during the Caleb Plant fight. And I think the last like 6 rounds, they didn't have anything but promotion.
Yeah.
And
that's
I just wonder, yeah, like what's the, if your show is peaking at that point and you're not showing any ads, who's getting anything out of it? This is the dynamic that I don't fully grasp. But I would imagine if you're not showing ads, Bud Light ads or whatever it is, ads during that peak time, the money's not coming in, right?
The equation for that is tough to work out. And you want to provide the fans with a great experience. And I'm sure that's what the narrative will be from their end. But at the same time, like obviously the advertisers, they look at the average number of viewers. They look at the peak number of viewers. They look at when their ad got shown. They look at the sort of the total GRPs, and like they're looking at, like they're watching it like a hawk. I mean, that's, the numbers come in and the numbers just are what they are. So I think that that's something that Fox will have to work out. But the strong takeaways right now are that it's, so far, it seems to be a sustainable thing that we can see boxing on FS1. I mean, and to your earlier point, Caleb Plant and Jose Uzcategui are not names that automatically make you think like, oh, I got to turn on FS1 to watch that. Like, these aren't, even for hardcore fans, these are names you've heard of and maybe you've seen once or twice, but not like your regular sort of steady diet of you know, great fighters who have established names.
And you pronounced Uzcategui correctly, so props to you. You already better than me on this podcast here. Let me ask you about, from a boxing perspective, Keith Thurman, it was his first fight in almost 2 years. He said he was not going to be, you're not going to get his fastball, his A game, basically. He did have some trouble in that 7th round against Josito Lopez, but for the most part, he was in control of that fight. He did land a big shot early on that put Lopez down. What were your impressions of watching Thurman, and do you still look at him at this point as a top-tier welterweight?
I think he is a top-tier welterweight. I think he has the best resume of any champ at welterweight, and Manny, I'm not counting Manny Pacquiao's sort of paper title there.
Yeah.
But I looked at that as shaking off rust, but with warning signs. I mean, I would still probably favor him if he fought most people. I think Sean Porter would be someone I might not favor him against. But then when he steps up to the really sort of A-list, like I wouldn't favor him against Crawford or Spence right now. And that's purely on the eye test. But I think you do when you haven't fought in 2 years, I mean, that's a long time. That's a lot of rust to shake off. I'll give him a pass for that. You know.
What do you think of a Thurman-Pacquiao fight? Because that seems to be one. Well, Thurman, I should say, Thurman wants it. Everybody wants it, especially after the pay-per-view that Manny just did. Manny still means big money for these welterweights that are out there. But if Thurman winds up getting that shot, who would you favor?
It's a great question. I mean, I'd probably actually favor Pacquiao. But
that's incredible. At 40, we're favoring Pacquiao against the guy who 2 years ago we said was number one in the division.
It's one of the pay-per-views that, if that got made, that's one of those coin flip pay-per-views, though, which is great. I mean, there's not too many of those right now. So that's, like, I would really look forward to that. I mean, I think, you know, Pacquiao actually, like, stylistically, like, he might even give Spence some trouble because Spence gives up rounds, you know. I think, like, Spence would have to knock him out and might be able to, but I'm not sure Thurman could. I mean, Thurman's style has changed quite a bit over the years.
Yeah, I think Thurman should probably take one more B-level fight, and then he'd be ready for a Pacquiao, but Pacquiao might not be available to him.
Exactly.
If he takes one more fight, because who knows what happens to Manny. I mean, I think the next welterweight to get their hands on him might be able to finish off his career if they can do it. So I would jump at that opportunity. I kind of like that fight too, because Manny showed me a little more than I thought he had left. He's still nowhere near that kind of whirling dervish we saw 10 years ago, but it's really remarkable that a fighter who has fought as long as Pacquiao, and we're not talking about Hopkins here, where you defend yourself and you don't take a lot of punches. This guy took some mammoth shots over the years, fought some of the best in boxing, and fought them in absolute wars, and he's still out there throwing a bunch of punches, going to the body, being active. It really is a marvel. I won't say miracle, but a marvel that Pacquiao's still doing this.
It's remarkable, and for a period of his career, wasn't like it didn't live that sort of, you know, Bernard Hopkins monk-ish sort of life outside the ring either.
No. Still may not be. Still may. Who knows what's actually going on behind the scenes at Pacquiao's. By the way, Team Pacquiao, you guys should be embarrassed, man. The guy got robbed. You have 500 people like around that house. You can't leave one back to like hang out there and make sure he doesn't get robbed. I mean, come on. Be better. Be better there. Let me ask you one more question about the way the PBC and the Fox broadcasts are working. I got crucified by the Haymanites and the PBC folks recently on social media because I think it's kind of goofy that their shoulder programming ignores everybody else in boxing. And, you know, people came at me. It's like, oh, you're just saying that because you're working with the zone. No, I mean, I don't understand why shoulder program would completely ignore every other boxer that's out there. Not to say you need to pay as much attention to what's happening with like Canelo or Terrence Crawford, but ignoring them, I don't think that does anybody any favors. I thought it was bizarre watching them. The broadcast I watched, they were on there talking about Gennady Golovkin's options, and they mentioned the PBC and other platforms. Like, what am I watching here? Am I wrong? I mean, is it better business to only talk about the fighters that exist within your universe, or is it better business to look at the totality of boxing when you're doing shows like that?
See, with the shoulder programming, if you want to actually make money selling ads against shoulder programming, you need to gear it towards hardcore boxing fans, and they just won't go for that stuff. I mean, maybe there's a small crowd of just people who love the PBC and nothing else who want to see this, but I think most people would take your exact take on this. Like, they're going to look at this and say, like, you're just kind of lying to me, or you're hiding a large part of the truth. And I hope that changes. I mean, you know, even I saw on DAZN, they're interviewing Shakur Stevenson. I like stuff like that. I think you should, you know, sort of explore the entire boxing universe. Of course, you should be focused on the stuff that's happening on your network. But it goes back to that sort of big J journalism versus small J journalism. And I think ESPN is having this conversation in like a much greater context now. And, you know, you're like, what is it like, at what point do you stop sort of making programming that's just marketing your fights and address the sport at large? I think most hardcore fans want programming that addresses the sport at large and gives full context.
Yeah, I mean, when Mike Coppinger went on there and gave his information about Golovkin and what he was going to be doing, they cut back to the panel discussion, and it was Sean Porter and it was Abner Mares. And Mares was asked in like a leading way, like plenty of good fights for Golovkin over on the PBC side. And it took him 30 seconds. He couldn't name anybody. He literally, and I'm not trying to criticize Abner. I like Abner. But he's sort of hemming and hawing. Finally, Porter jumps in with Charlo. Like, that's it. Like, that's the only guy on that side of the street. Look, if Golovkin winds up signing there, it's his life, his business. You know, he's going to make a lot of money no matter what he does. But let's not sit there and act like the PBC side of the street is the best place for him legacy-wise, that there's more fights for him over there than there are at other places.
Yeah, totally agree. I mean, when you look at what Fox is doing, and there's actually two models for this that sort of started on the Fox side. They didn't have this problem with the UFC because 85 or 90% of the best fighters were in the UFC. So they could just talk about the sport at large and not really have to address what was going on in other sort of MMA leagues. In the NFL, though, you can't, like, how could you ever get away with that? It's crazy.
I think the analogy I made was it's like doing a baseball show and talking about the Central Division. Or a basketball show and doing it that way. And before people say, like, I'm only criticizing the PBC again, I feel the same way about Dimitri Bivol. Like, what is Dimitri Bivol doing? Like, he signs over with DAZN, and he's the only 175-pounder on the block, whereas everybody else, more or less, is over on the ESPN side of the street. And here comes Bivol. Now, if Bivol is going to drop down to 168 and fight Callum Smith, I'll have a different opinion. But if he's a 175-pounder, he's not going to get many big fights after he fights Joe Smith. So, I mean, guys have to make decisions. Like, they can make real money, but they have to accept that, at least for now, cross-pollination just doesn't seem like it's likely.
Yeah, I think what you're seeing a lot of is certain entities are taking over certain divisions, kind of like what you mentioned with light heavyweight at ESPN. And then there's a lot of big money fights there. And the people left out, yes, maybe they can make some entertaining TV fights, but eventually they're going to have to figure out a way to, you know, sort of, whether it's purse bids, whether it's horse trading, whether it's pay-per-view, they're going to have to figure out a way to work together and fight some of the, you know, unify and make some of those better fights.
Yeah, I completely agree. All right, let's talk about DAZN here for a minute, and I'll give you most of the floor on this one, as I am an employee of DAZN on the side doing part of their broadcast. They opened up in September. They had the Anthony Joshua fight, big fight at Wembley Stadium. Since then, they have been signing some big-name fighters, but have yet to have that marquee fight. That is expected to be take place first in May with Canelo Alvarez versus Danny Jacobs. There's some optimism there that we're headed towards Jarrell Miller versus Anthony Joshua, which to me is at least interesting, more interesting than a Dillian White rematch, and who knows what happens with Golovkin. So I think they're barreling towards some pretty big fights, but haven't had any quite yet. Give me your thoughts on the first few months of DAZN and everything they're trying to do.
Well, so the way I've looked at it is, at least, certainly in the fall, you kind of had two categories of programming on DAZN. You had this one category of really quality stuff. The World Boxing Super Series, I loved everything that was going on there. You had Eddie Hearn's UK pay-per-view cards, which were, you know, you got the Usyk fight, you got the Povetkin-AJ fight there. That was all really quality stuff. I think the stuff that was happening in the United States was hit or miss. You know, like, there were some, okay, there were a couple good fights on some of the cards. Some of the cards had a lot of mismatches. That November 17th card I've killed, and it deserves it. It was a terrible card, top to bottom. I'm very optimistic. I love DAZN's business model. And second of all, I think you do have to give them a little bit of time to develop this. Like, it's not something that can happen overnight, and they're not charging you that much money for it. So I would look at it and say, like, hey, the time between Canelo's first fight against Rocky Fielding and his next fight May 4th against Daniel Jacobs, like, that's the time where we really got to start seeing some quality fight, you know, quality fights happening regularly. And we've even, like, in January, I wasn't a fan going in of the first two cards, and I think the one on the 19th wasn't that great, although you did get the one upset with Linares and Cano. Mm. But I actually thought the two fights, the co-main and the main event last weekend, were really fun TV. I mean, even with Munguia, he was a big favorite, but we ended up learning a lot about him. And that, I mean, the undercard, the main event undercard was, I mean, that's like an early contender for fight of the year. I don't think it was fought at the highest skill level, but I, you know, like, if that was an HBO Boxing After Dark, people would be going crazy on it.
Yeah, I agree. That was a really fun fight between Sushan and Jesus Rojas. That was neither one of those guys, massive punches. The Rojas, a pretty big puncher, yep. But Zhukan came in with two knockouts and was just blasting away for the entire fight. You said you liked the business model that DAZN has. Why do you like it?
Well, it's streaming, and a lot of this comes from my background. So a lot of my former coworkers from HBO now work at streaming services, you know, in Amazon, Netflix, like those kind of places. The company I work at, we do business with these types of places. They, for a lot of reasons, have a much better, I think, way to sort of attack the issue. So first of all, in terms of ad sales and subscriptions, like, and DAZN and ESPN Plus do sell ads. What a lot of people haven't been talking about is programmatic television ads, which is basically the concept that you can give almost every, like sort of on a grand scale, you can give each person watching their own TV ad and you can make much more money doing that. Like the sort of the concept would be if you're watching an NFL game on Sunday afternoon, if Fox, let's just use round numbers. Let's say Fox, there's 20 million people watching it and they're charging 500 grand for a 30-second ad. What can happen is, well, maybe 30% of the people watching don't drink beer or something like that. So instead of having a Bud Light ad not be effective for 30% of the people, that 30% of the people can get a different ad. And instead of getting 500 grand for the 30 seconds, Bud Light pays a little bit less. The other company pays a little bit less, but Fox gets more than the 500 grand, you know, to sell the ad. That's really tough to do in the cable system because you don't have a one-on-one relationship with your subscriber. But in these services like ESPN Plus and DAZN, where you have a one-on-one relationship with your provider, you know exactly the viewing habits and, you know, a lot of other behavioral habits of your subscriber, and you can tailor those ads so they're really targeted and make a lot of money doing it. So I think that's a really interesting thing on the business side. I also think that if you make the events, just purely from the DAZN on the boxing side, if you make these big events really happen and don't put them on pay-per-view, and you sort of follow that WWE model, I think that can be successful in boxing. It can definitely be successful in boxing. I think they have a great chance to do it. And I think I'm impressed by the MLB deal. I would love to see, some soccer come on there. But I think with the way they use data, and I did an interview for Ring Magazine with, you know, Joseph Markowski, super smart guy. I was very impressed with how they were leveraging data from all over the world and using it to their advantage. Now, they will have to hit a certain subscriber number to actually make all this work in the United States. And I think that happens with big fights, not just big names, not just big fighters, but big fights.
No question. You're not going to drive as big a draw as Canelo Alvarez is. You can't keep doing the Canelo Rocky fielding types. Yep. It expects people to not only go to it, but also stay. You mentioned the WWE Network. The biggest issue it had, and one that I'm sure DAZN will have down the line, is the churn rate. You know, yep. People subscribing, they unsubscribe, they subscribe again. I remember looking at those WWE Network numbers. They would swing by like 400,000, from month to month, and sometimes even more. It was wild looking at them. But to your point about the business model, I think a lot of people look at DAZN charging $10 a month and a pay-per-view generating revenue of $75 a pop and saying, well, how can that equate? I don't think enough people understand where all that pay-per-view money actually goes. I mean, can you break that down for me? Like, the $75 that I submitted in buying Manny Pacquiao versus Adrian Broner, how is that money broken up?
So, and that's something I've hit on a lot on my podcast. Right. If you bought that fight, basically 50% of it goes to cable companies who distribute the fight. And Showtime also takes a distribution fee. And now there's a sliding scale. It's usually between 30 and 50% for what the distribution fee is. And it depends on how many ads they run and what kind of promotions they run. You know, there's sort of a sliding scale equation for it. But to me, that's almost like a moral injustice to the fighter because when a fight airs on Showtime or when a fight airs on ESPN or anywhere, the promoter and the fighters get basically 100% of the revenue. And to then, like, the argument has always been with pay-per-view that, oh, well, the fighters are going to make more money. But it's not like, like when the NBA signed their new contract, everybody kept the same percentages or similar percentages as, you know, all this new money kept coming into the sport. And I don't think, I think 20, 30 years ago when there was pay-per-view, the cable companies actually did do, they had a real role in getting the fight, sort of getting a lot of the marketing out. I mean, TV ads were basically the main way to market a fight back then. These days, there's much more sophisticated ways to do it. I think it's crazy that we're still at the point where 50% of the revenue goes, you know, to some, I mean, like, it's shocking. The cable companies are just basically screwing you over. I've talked about it a lot. I wish there was a different way to do it. But it still is the best way to generate the most money for a fight. I think there's ways to change that, though.
Yeah, I mean, could you ever imagine, I mean, Showtime does this already, but let's say, for example, Showtime does the Fury Wilder rematch. And maybe that's too soon for something like this to happen. But down the line, could you ever see, like, Showtime streaming it on their app and cutting out that distributor middleman? Because you're right, 20 years ago, you probably needed the cable operator to help you promote it. Nowadays, there are dozens of ways. Social media does it more than a cable operator does it in some respects. Could you ever see that happening where a network would put it on its own streaming platform?
Well, it depends which network. So I pitched this numerous times at HBO, and it obviously never happened. And one of the main reasons, I actually don't blame them. So HBO and Showtime, still, their largest chunk of revenue that they get is comes from checks that get cut from cable companies or, you know, or those types of distributors. So they can't, it's not in their best interest to upset those kind of companies. Like, when you're getting billions of dollars from, you know, DirecTV or whoever, you know, Cox Cable, whichever one it is, of course you don't want to screw them over on some kind of, like, let's be honest, like, relatively small issue. I mean, it's big in the sport of boxing, but to hit these companies' bottom lines, like, we're still talking about not a whole lot of money here for their bottom lines.
So, do you think, go ahead.
No, I mean, so I don't know that you're going to see it necessarily. There's no incentive to do it on Showtime. Now, what happens is, for you as a customer, if you go and buy it on the Showtime streaming app and don't buy it through your cable provider, Showtime just takes all that extra money, basically.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's... Stephen Espinoza did an interesting interview with Keith Idek before... I think it was before the Fury-Wilder fight, but he talked about the future of pay-per-view. And one thing he brought up was, you know, I think there's interest amongst people like him in reducing the price of pay-per-view to potentially expand the audience. The thinking being, if it's $50 instead of $75, maybe you do, you know, 800,000 viewers or 800,000 buyers instead of the 300,000. But fighters, they just don't want to do it because it's too big a risk. It's a bird in the hand with what they have in the current model. Do you think we'll ever get to that point where you'll see the cost come down in an experiment to try to draw up the numbers? And do you think those numbers would go up significantly if you cut a pay-per-view price from 75 to 50?
So I think they would go up. I think in some of it might be fight dependent, but I think they would go up. But if I understand the hesitancy, so boxing is a single night event. So I do understand the hesitancy to change anything like that. I think you're much more likely to see it. Now, maybe the PBC as a whole could do something like that. I think you're much more likely to see it something like that coming from the UFC or something like that, though, where you have one brand controlling all of it and you can make those decisions across basically the entire sport. It's tougher in boxing. It's just, you know, with so many different ways of doing it. Now, what you might see, to your point, you might see some benefits potentially being offered down the line of, like, oh, hey, you're a Showtime subscriber, you might get some kind of benefit. You're an ESPN Plus subscriber, you might get some kind of benefit. Like, that stuff, I think, is realistic. I think it is realistic, you know, especially in the bigger fights when they do happen. You know, the real chance to do this was Mayweather-Pacquiao. That's where HBO and Showtime could have not necessarily reduced the price, but really cut down on the distribution fees, and they didn't do it. So, and I mean, I worked on that fight. Like, there was just... there were too many other things to worry about and fight about, so that didn't happen.
Oh, I loved covering the fighting, the infighting between HBO and Showtime. That was one of my favorite sports for those months prior, because you'd go to HBO, some of the people I knew there with some stuff, and you come back to Showtime with some stuff. It just became the drama. I'm not sure who was interested in it, but I sure was, and it sure made me laugh when I thought about the because everybody was trying to one up each other during that fight. It was like, well, we got the rights to this, and we have the rights to that, and our talent's doing this, and our talent's doing that. So it became like a pissing contest between the two sides. It was wild.
The AJ Klitschko fight might have actually been worse. We're sitting there on the marketing side, just waiting to be able to promote the fight, and we couldn't promote the fight for a long time.
I remember that. I remember Showtime being pissed because I think initially they thought HBO was going to announce it during a Lomachenko fight, and they didn't do it. I don't know. I do enjoy the griping phone calls I get from people on both sides. It's always entertaining. Not as entertaining as the Lou DiBella phone call at 1 a.m., but they're always entertaining. All right, a couple other questions about some of the DAZN stuff. So they're trying to drive subscriptions, right? Like they need to get to a certain number. They're big names out there, and you worked at HBO when Canelo Alvarez was their number one attraction for a long time. Do you look at Canelo as a subscriber driver for DAZN?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the right fights, definitely, definitely. Even in the wrong fights, like even in a Rocky Fielding fight, which to DAZN's, I don't want to say to their credit, but they had no choice in that part of it. So it was like, you want Canelo, you get the Rocky Fielding fight. So they did that. And I'm actually, it's not that I'm okay with that. It's like, if you're running a business, that might be a decent test run. Like, you may not want to go straight into Canelo Triple G 3, where you're potentially facing, like, the worst thing that could happen is a version of what happened to Time Warner Cable in New York for Mayweather-Pacquiao, where the fight is basically getting delayed because all these people can't figure out how to order it because you've overloaded the system. You don't want that to happen. So I think it's okay starting out like that, but now the pressure's on. I mean, we've seen the results of that. I think Canelo Jacobs, it wouldn't be the same subscriber driver as Canelo Triple G, but that's a really good one. That's a really quality fight, and I think it will drive subs.
I think it should. I think they'd be ecstatic if it did over DAZN. I think it should do over 1 million subscribers. I think that's a fair number to look for when you're only charging $10 for it, and this is a pay-per-view. I mean, how many pay-per-views, in your opinion, would Canelo Jacobs drive if it was a pay-per-view fight?
It wouldn't drive 1 million, I don't think.
No.
But it would get, and I think it does depend on the price. I mean, I think you started to see that 1.1 for Canelo Triple G 2 was a disappointment, and $85, I think, did have something to do with that.
Yeah.
So, at a $75 price range, I mean, without doing research on the comps, I'd, somewhere in the $600 to $800 range, probably, like something like that. That feels about right. Maybe $650, $700.
So is 1 million subscribers to DAZN a reasonable expectation?
I think that's an incredibly ambitious number. But
really? Okay.
I think it can easily do, I think it will do better, or I would predict it would do better than what ESPN announced that the UFC on ESPN Plus did for them, which was 560 or 580,000, something like that. I think 1 million is possible. There are definitely pathways to getting 1 million subscribers for that Canelo Jacobs fight, for sure. Mm-hmm.
What about Anthony Joshua? Because so far we've only seen him fight over in the UK. His numbers on Showtime weren't great. Granted, those were afternoon shows, so you have to take that into account. Do you look at him in the same vein for big fights, he's a subscriber driver, or is he different than Canelo in that sense?
Well, so, and this is even something to add to Canelo, I think. So when you look at AJ and Canelo, DAZN has the worldwide rights to Canelo. So not only is he, part of that discussion is his subscriber numbers in the U.S., but part of that discussion is, if DAZN wants to enter any new market, you're entering it with Canelo as a bird in hand. Like, that's huge. That's huge, especially if you're entering Latin American markets. AJ, I think for the right markets in Europe, he could have the same effect. I think in the United States, he might help against churn, but I don't think he's a big enough star in the United States to, like, actually actively get subs, a whole lot of them, certainly. Now, in the Wilder fight, if they ever did that, I think that would get subs. That is a huge fight that in the United States would bring subscriptions.
What do you think about a Joshua and Miller fight down the line? I mean, we don't know what's going to happen yet. Dillian White is still in the mix. But I think, we know Eddie Hearn would love to make Jarrell Miller versus Anthony Joshua. We'll see what happens there. But I mean, not even in the sense of subscribers, really, at this point. In terms of a fight, what do you think of Joshua Miller?
I think it's probably a fun fight. Like, AJ, every time he fights for me, is quality television just because you see some of that vulnerability, but you also see some of that great technical skill. And he's not a complete technician. He is vulnerable. I don't know that Miller is the guy to expose that. Miller might, you know, he might not have quite enough power for that. But I think it's a fun fight. I definitely think it's a fun fight.
Yeah, and if I'm Jarrell Miller, I can't screw this up.
If
there's a real offer on the table, you got to take it, because it could be like a year before he gets the opportunity again, if ever. Because eventually we're going to get a Wilder fight. I think Eddie's playing a very, very long game with this. But if Wilder knocks out Fury and Anthony Joshua stops Dillian White, the interest will have peaked in a Wilder versus Joshua fight. And the same for Fury versus Joshua. Fury winds up beating Deontay Wilder. So if you're Jarrell Miller and you're, you know, nickel and diamond here, you're making a big mistake. Yep. Your people are making a big mistake.
Totally agree. This is not the fight to nickel and dime. Take this fight. Make it. If you even have a good showing, like, a loss is totally okay in this fight. Just a good showing will keep you in the mix for much bigger fights and much bigger – well, not much bigger fights, but continue to be involved in that big fight picture and much bigger paydays down the line. You've got – this is your chance to establish yourself.
Yeah, win a few rounds, go to a decision. If that's the worst-case scenario for you, you're back on DAZN 3 months later. You can run your mouth and try to get a rematch, you know, down the line. I'd be incredibly disappointed if Miller held this up and it became because of him. One thing I want to ask you about Munguia. You said you learned something about Jaime Munguia in that last fight. I learned that he needs to get away from 154 pounds. Like, it's enough already. I know that on Friday he was having real problems getting down to that 154-pound limit. He got there, to his credit. He did his job, but Friday was a tough day for Jaime Munguia. And if you were going to tell me, Evan, that, you know, this year we're going to get Munguia, Jarrett Hurd for the unified title, or we're going to get Munguia, Tony Harrison in this next fight, or even Munguia, Charlo in a fight, in a major fight, I'd say sure, make 154. But they're talking about Dennis Hogan. They're talking about Jesse Vargas. Like, they're not talking about big fights for Jaime Munguia. I don't understand why he's intent and why his team is intent on staying at 154. You move up to 160, you don't have to fight Demetrius Andrade right away, though he's frothing for that fight. You don't have to take him on immediately, but start the process of adjusting yourself to 160 pounds. To me, staying at 154 makes zero sense for him.
I agree completely. I wrestled in high school and college. I've had to make horrible weight cuts. It really has a major effect on you. I think he should, if he's going to take lesser fights, do it at 160. I agree completely. Like, he's not, when you look at the effect the weight cut had on him, it clearly affected him in the ring. It probably affected his power. And I think he has a long ways to go in terms of developing skill and like fighting against fighters like Demetrius Andrade. You looked at his performance there, you looked at his performance against like Liam Smith. I mean, he could lose 10, 11, 12 rounds if he fought Demetrius Andrade. Now, he could also knock him out. I think that's what makes Jaime Munguia exciting, but the skill level needs to be developed, and he's got to grow into himself a little bit more. I mean, I think it also, it hurts his power by sucking down so much in terms of the weight.
Yeah, he also needs to work on his defense. Because, in a way, if you just look at the scorecard, you say, well, Munguia won going away. It wasn't like that. Inoue landed some big shots in that fight. And he gets hit by 160-pound shots like that. It's problematic.
Agree completely.
It's problematic for Jaime Munguia. But I would see him. Like, I think you put him, especially since he's aligned with Golden Boy and he's going to be part of that kind of DAZN mix. There are a lot of fun fights. Even without Golovkin, and I still hope that, you know, for the boxing's sake, that Golovkin winds up fighting on DAZN, so those big fights. But even without him, there are some really interesting 160-pound fights can be made over the next year or so. On Saturday, we're going to have the rematch between Eleider Alvarez and Sergey Kovalev. Back in August, Alvarez stunned a lot of people, I would say myself included. I was ringside for that fight in Atlantic City where Alvarez knocked out Sergey Kovalev. It was an impressive performance, but it once again reinforced to me that Sergey Kovalev has no idea what to do when he gets hurt. You saw him against Andre Ward. When he got hurt, he didn't know how to deal with it. He couldn't cover up. He couldn't tie up. He's never willing to take a knee. Same thing with Alvarez. When he got hit, he wound up fighting a completely wrong fight. Now, we're hearing the same stuff, Evan, from Kovalev we heard in years past. We're overtraining. He's got a new trainer now. Buddy McGirt's in his corner. Let's start with in the ring, the rematch. Do you think this can go any differently or will go any differently than the first fight did?
I would say Alvarez by knockout. The odds makers have this as almost as close to a pick'em fight as you can make in boxing, which is really great. That's a great sign. I mean, I think it's a great fight. But if from what I've seen, Sergey Kovalev is showing all the signs of a fighter who is approaching the cliff and about to fall off it in terms of their performance level for a lot of the reasons you mentioned. I mean, there's so many question marks as to what's happening in his personal life. Now, that all being said, he could easily come back and show what he did in the ring for many of the rounds in the first fight and win the fight and prove everybody wrong. But I think whether that comes this fight or even in the next fight or two, I think that's coming for him. Like he's showing all those signs of fighters. Rarely do fighters get to this point in their career and have that Bernard Hopkins type moment where they come back and then have a really long productive career where they get a lot of big paydays and win more titles. Like usually this is the time when it all starts to go downhill.
Let me ask you this. Kovalev was has been accused of a pretty violent domestic violence incident happened up at Big Bear last year. Now, in other sports, we put the responsibility on the teams and the league to deal with that. The NFL's got obviously a checkered history with it. The NBA's dealt with it to some degree, to a lesser degree, certainly. We don't really criticize the networks. Like, if there's a domestic violence incident and a player is playing, we don't go after Turner or ESPN for putting that game still on. Boxing's a little bit different, right? Because ESPN is footing the bill, really, for all this with their license fees that they're putting up. Do you think that networks, ESPN or otherwise, should be criticized for putting fighters involved with this kind of thing on the air?
I don't, and that might sound weird. I mean, well, not weird. That might sound, you know, cliche coming from a former network executive, but I think these guys deserve their day in court. I mean, he's been accused of something. Okay, that's fine, but in the United States, unless there's a collective bargaining agreement like there is in the NFL or the NBA, these guys deserve their day in court, and he hasn't had his day in court yet. So, like, I think it's no problem to have him fight from my end. Now, I do think in the broadcast there should be context for what he's accused of, for maybe the effect that that's had on him in his training, and just adding context to the fight that you're watching in the ring. But, you know, let him have his day in court. I mean, if these accusations are true, then that's really bad, but he would probably face much worse repercussions than not fighting on ESPN. He'd probably have to go to jail. And I like the only other thing I'd add to that, before I ever worked at HBO, I worked at a talent agency with really high-level actors and stuff like that. And what I'd say is this, I'm always skeptical of this stuff. Like, I'm skeptical of the accusations until you get more information about them, because these guys are targets. They're definitely targets. Now, that doesn't mean I'm pro actor or pro star. It just means they're gonna, because they're targets, they're gonna get accused of this more than your average person, and you have to take that into consideration, especially when their living is made off of getting in the ring and making money. Like, that's what they do for a living.
Yeah, and I would also add that it is kind of a slippery slope that you step on, especially in boxing, where fighters have done some pretty horrifying things over the years. I mean, people forget what Adonis Stevenson was before he became light heavyweight champion. He was an actual pimp. He went to prison. Like, some of the things he did or was accused of doing and was convicted of doing to women were pretty horrible. So I think it becomes difficult to decide who you're going to put on and who you're not going to put on. To a degree.
I agree. I mean, and Floyd went to prison. No one stopped watching him. I mean, the opposite happened. And I think you need to have that ability to separate watching the person in the ring from what they're doing outside the ring. Because most people that's all they care about. They care about watching someone inside the ring, and they want to, when they want to watch boxing, they want to watch the best. And this fight is a great fight. Like, this is the first sort of really high profile non pay-per-view fight. I mean, I guess it is on ESPN Plus. That's, I would not consider that pay-per-view, but it's really the first non pay-per-view fight, like big fight of the year. And like, you know, I think people just want to see it.
Yeah. And look, ESPN's not going to ignore it either. Like,
no, they'll provide context.
Kriegel's not going to ignore it. Is Andre Ward going to be on that broadcast? Is he part of the – are they going to do a studio show with him? Because that would be interesting.
I would assume so, that they do the thing where he's at a desk with – you know, because this is – they've done that for all the bigger fights. They've even done that for some of the, you know, normal fights, like where he's at a desk with one or two other people. And then you've got the normal booth, and they'll cut to him at various points.
Yeah, that should be interesting, having Ward part of that mix. all right, let me finish also with ESPN. They do have a pay-per-view, their first pay-per-view coming up on April 20th. Amir Khan is going to challenge Terrence Crawford for his title. This is a fight, Evan, that has been roundly criticized on social media, and I feel like I don't really get it. I don't think Amir Khan is an elite welterweight at this point. But it's not like he's over the hill. He's had some you know, his issues with chasing Pacquiao and Mayweather over the years. He's fought some really soft touches, and his last soft touch he got knocked down in the early rounds. But this fight is being criticized as a massive mismatch. And the only question I would have to people that say that is, what would you prefer at this point? I mean, at one point, it was supposed to be Terrence Crawford against Luis Collazo. Like, are you really into seeing Crawford versus Collazo that you're that angry that it's Khan? Is it the fact that they're putting it on pay-per-view that's making you angry? Why do you think that this Khan-Crawford fight is being so beaten up?
I think it's, you know, it's probably that it's put on pay-per-view with, and I think most people, the initial odds came out, and it's, you know, I think it, like it's down to, I think there's some places where it's down to like 7-1 or something like that, which is still, you know, not great odds. But to me, I mean, Amir Khan has a real pathway to victory. Like, and yes. I think Amir Khan makes fun television. So, you know, if
this is not puncher's chance for Amir
exactly,
Khan.
Exactly.
It's like, not.
He has a real pathway to victory. And, you know, it even got, like, if you look at what Crawford, if you look at his fight against Gamboa and you substitute Amir Khan for Gamboa, you know, obviously Crawford ended up getting the knockout, but Amir Khan up 4 or 5 rounds to none or one or something like that. I mean, that's really exciting television, and that in high drama, and he could pull it off. I mean, he has pulled it off before, especially with guys that aren't as big as Canelo. That's really, you know, he makes good television. Now, I understand the criticism that it's on pay-per-view, and I put this in the same category as the Spence Garcia fight, where these are two fights going on a pay-per-view, perceived mismatches from the get-go. You think that, but both B-sides do have a pathway to victory. I mean, Mikey Garcia has a pathway to victory against Errol Spence. I don't think it's likely. I think that probably Errol Spence and Terrence Crawford will both win by knockout, but both the B-sides definitely can win.
Yeah, if Amir Khan would box and not try to be a tough guy and fight, he can win. Like, he absolutely can win.
Totally.
He's still fast. He can still do a lot. He's still highly skilled. Yeah, I don't know what to make. Maybe you can tell me what you think here. What to make of the last two fights? I mean, Phil LaGreca was a joke. I mean,
yeah,
that was
dumb. A complete joke. Yeah.
And then Samuel Vargas, he's, you know, he gets knocked down. I think it was at the first round or the second round. He gets put down, and then he just outboxes Vargas in the way to a lopsided decision. I don't know what we learned about Khan, because this will be just his third fight in the last 3 years. Took almost 2 years off between the Alvarez knockout and the LaGreco fight. So I don't know what we learned from the Vargas fight that's going to tell us anything about Amir Khan.
I mean, we probably learned really similar things to what we learned about Keith Thurman, because if you don't count the LaGreco, I mean, that was less than a minute. So, like, it's hard to shake off your ring rust when you just come in and on your, whatever, third or fourth punch, basically knock the guy out. We learned really, you know, we saw him get rid of some ring rust. And he actually did it, you know, usually the ring rust happens in the first couple rounds. I mean, Thurman actually looked great in the first couple rounds. Khan got knocked down and he kind of survived, and then he outboxed and clearly won, you know, but even that was like a pretty dramatic moment. I mean, that's kind of what Amir Khan does.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about the pay-per-view aspect of this. You mentioned earlier that HBO, the largest chunk of revenue they got they get comes from the cable providers, right? Is that what you said?
Yep.
Am I getting that right?
Yep.
Is it the same, though, for ESPN? I mean, my question with this is, like, maybe HBO needs that pay-per-view money, but does ESPN really need that pay-per-view money? In other words, do they not get more value, or at least is there an argument that they get as much value from putting it on a linear platform, or even putting it on ESPN Plus, as they would distributing it on pay-per-view?
Well, ESPN gets, they make money selling ads, so they get much, they still get a huge amount of money from cable companies, but they also, it's a much less piece of the pie. It's much less overall percentage of their revenue. So yes, they that stuff matters. I do think, see, I mean, I think if you look, if you take a step back and look at what's happening in pay-per-view overall right now, one of these fights is bound to fail. And like, I question whether it's going to be either the fight on Fox. Fox actually probably has the least to benefit from cable companies because, you know, the only channels that they have on cable companies are like Fox Sports, Fox News. They do get some retransmission fees, and I think, you know, but I'm not enough of an expert to know exactly where that money comes from. I don't think it comes from cable companies directly. They might pay some of it. But I think in both scenarios, it like, yes, there are other ways to do it. And I think it's going to take one of these things to tank before people realize, oh, we can't constantly be putting these level fights on pay-per-view. I don't know exactly which fight that'll be. I think actually in both of these instances, I'm pretty sure both ESPN and Fox won't want their first foray into pay-per-view to stink. So they're going to put a lot of effort behind it, and you might see some casuals buy the fight that wouldn't have bought it if it was HBO or Showtime. So I don't know if it's going to come in one of these next two fights, but when you look at what's happening on the schedule, one of these is going to fail, and I think the pay-per-view market isn't – there's just a number where it's not sustainable to have all these fights on pay-per-view and people to keep paying it.
Yeah, I think Fox has by far the highest likelihood of being the one to fail because, you know, ESPN is going to promote the crap out of it, you know, for, you know, every day, you know, for the week of the fight. It'll be in New York. They'll have all these guys on their shows. You'll see Terrence Crawford on Get Up. You'll see Amir Khan on SportsCenter. Whereas now that football's over and that fight's in March, where is Fox going to promote? I mean, they'll do it on FS1, I'm sure, to a degree, but it won't be anywhere near the type of foot push. Plus, and I don't know how you feel about the value of a promoter in something like this, but you're going to have Arum everywhere, you know, griping about something and, you know, the top-ranked machine behind that fight, whereas, you know, Al Haymon doesn't talk, and I don't know who's behind that fight. I don't even know who's the official promoter of that fight. Is it Lou? Is it Tom Brown? I mean, I don't even know. So I think that could be problematic for Fox after the football season's over.
Yeah, the infrastructure definitely matters. PBC in general has experience putting on pay-per-views that do really, really well. They don't have a lot of experience sort of building pay-per-view stars, and Fox obviously doesn't have experience doing real pay-per-views. So that part, you do have to, I mean, that's a question mark for sure. I think all that can be overcome if Fox really promotes it on their traditional programming, but to your point, there's no NFL games in March, so that's a huge hurdle.
Yeah, and, you know, I guess what I'm thinking about why Fox isn't just putting it on their main network and trying to draw 3-4 million viewers to a fight like that, it reminds me that, was the last fight on CBS, the Thurman Porter fight, was that almost 2 years ago?
I think both Thurman Garcia, maybe.
I think both Thurman Garcia
and Thurman Porter were on CBS, I believe.
But those did big numbers, right? Those did over 3 million.
Oh, Thurman Garcia peaked at over 5 million.
Why do you think we haven't seen...
To me, that's crazy. To me, you have to do stuff like that. Like, to me, there's so much more value in getting 5 million people, a peak audience of 5 million people watching a fight than 225,000 or whatever it's going to be on pay-per-view. Now, obviously, there's some line in the sand where the math, the economics of it just works out better for the fighters, you know, where you can't have maybe a loss leader or an attempt at that. But I think it does so many things when you put a big fight. Like if they were putting Spence Garcia on Big Fox and not on pay-per-view, first of all, it increases your overall numbers in a real way. And that speaks to advertisers that probably all those ads that you're talking about on FS1, which were sort of maybe promos for PBC, those turn into ads, and those turn into, you know, better ads. You hit your numbers in a real way. Yeah, maybe with the guarantees that you're giving the fighters, maybe on a one-event basis, you look at it overall as a loss. But you can promote your upcoming fights with a huge audience during that fight. I think there's a real, like, you know, sort of rising tide effect when you do something like this. I wish they would have done it. I mean, I wish they would have, you know, done it earlier with the Pacquiao-Broner fight. I mean, I didn't know Pacquiao was guaranteed $20 million, according to Keith Idek, which obviously that takes that out of the equation. But I don't think the guarantees for Spence and Garcia are huge for this. I think that this is a candidate to do something like that.
The $20 million and the tax money, like, somebody's paying that. Like, where is that money? Who is writing that check? Like, that's a big check.
I talked about it last time. If you do the math where Pacquiao only got paid $10 million to fight that fight, okay, 400,000 buys might start to make sense, but $20 million, that just doesn't. There's just no way that makes sense. And I think, look, credit to, if he took a loss to get Pacquiao and just sort of pay his tax bill, look, credit to him. I mean, he did something that's, you know, I've said it before, like, that's why his fighters love him. He's giving them a great opportunity to get a win against a legend. And so now who's going to step up and take that fight?
Yeah, my understanding was it was, as Pacquiao was being courted by everybody, it was a prerequisite to anything. You had to pay his tax problem or deal with his tax problem to get that get that done. That's a nice piece of leverage to have there. To put a button on all this, it really is interesting, Evan, with boxing now. It's not like HBO versus Showtime or all that like it was for many, many years. You have kind of three groups doing three, I don't want to say unique, but different types of things. I mean, the PBC Fox side, for the most part, I mean, Showtime is obviously very much involved, but they're trying to succeed by putting it on free TV and showcasing it to the masses for the most part. ESPN to the masses as well, but using shoulder programming and promotion, and as well as trying to make ESPN Plus a thing. And then there's DAZN, which is trying to, you know, is going to reach a much smaller audience, but feels like it has a more sustainable economic model because they're getting $10 a month from their subscribers. I'll be really interested to see, like, if we do this podcast 3 years from now, like, how does this all shake out? Like, who emerges from these three, or do all three emerge? Is there room for all three in the boxing universe?
It's truly fascinating. I mean, it's really why I started my podcast, because I just, like I said, I wanted to stay involved, and then all this stuff kind of happened. And it's crazy. It's so much fun. Like, just the competing business models and what that's doing to fighters' salaries and how that's affecting who's fighting who and all that kind of stuff. And to your point, like, PBC is really doing two very different things, one on Showtime, one on Fox. ESPN within itself is in Top Rank is doing two very different things, one trying to get subscribership for ESPN Plus. And I think you can make a strong case that really the three main things that have driven subscribers for ESPN Plus so far are the UFC, that big announcement they made with all, you know, the several hundred thousand people who signed up on the one day for that big fight that was January 19th. Mm-hmm. You've got the one event where they converted, you know, I think about 300,000 subscribers from ESPN Insider to ESPN Plus. And then it's Top Rank Boxing. Like, those are the three main things that have driven it. I mean, they basically said that publicly. So it's really interesting. And those are competing interests to sell ads on regular TV against, you know, a fight is a different business model than building up a subscriber base and then lowering churn and maintaining a subscriber base.
Yeah, it's interesting. It sure is. Evan, thanks for coming in, man. The Aficionados podcast is on the Leave It in the Ring radio network. It takes a deep dive about every other week into the business of boxing. Evan also does some writing over at Ring Magazine. Welcome to the media side of the boxing world, my friend.
Thank you. It's been a fun little entrance into it. I've been there for a year. Now it's, you know, you've been on the network side. Now it's fun to be in the media side.
Sure is. Thanks for coming in, man. I appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
All right, that's it for this week's episode. As always, you can download archived episodes on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, post a comment, leave a rating. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.